The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Happold. This week, as the government publishes its vision for English schools, pupils walked out in protest against the sharp rise in university fees.
The people that are trying to tell us to pay are people that went to university for free, so who are they to tell us that we have to pay £9,000 to go uni?
Meanwhile, Nick Clegg used a keynote speech at The Guardian to reaffirm his political beliefs after junking an election pledge to scrap tuition fees.
I will defend the government's plans for reforming the funding of universities, even though it is not the one I campaigned for. It is not my party's policy, but it is the best policy given the choices we face.
And the Treasury finds £7 billion down the back of the sofa and packs it off to Dublin, where the bond markets have brought down Ireland's government. A busy week in politics and an all-star lineup in the pod. Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland is here, as is Observer columnist and chief leader writer Raphael Baer, and from the Centre Forum think tank, former Lib Dem advisor Julian Astill. Welcome to you all. When Tony Blair told the country his priority was education, 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 he ushered in a decade of huge spending on schools along with reform. Now, with the launch of the government's white paper this week, the money has run out. But the Blairite desire to give schools more independence burns brightly in the Conservative Education Secretary, Michael Gove.
If we're to make the most of the potential of every child, then we need to learn from those countries which outperform us educationally and have more equal societies. This white paper does just that. It takes the best ideas from the highest performing education nations and applies them to our own circumstances.
So bad teachers are about to get the boot, academic subjects get greater prominence, slimming down of the national curriculum, and a sergeant major in almost every classroom. But education columnist Fiona Miller says there are still big questions unanswered.
Well, I think he's got, I think he's right to focus on teaching quality. I think that is very important because, you know, it's all very well to say, yes, we want teaching to be better, but, you know, how do you make it better? It has to be a constant process of improvement and holding teachers to account. So you've got to have very tough and uncompromising heads, and you've also had to have governing bodies that are going to hold the heads and the schools to account. And I don't think he really addresses that issue. I think there's a danger that we lose some of the good things that have happened in the past 13 years, which is recognising the other things that schools can do for young people, the roles they play in their communities, and particularly how we meet the needs of certain types of disengaged young people for whom the strict academic curriculum isn't right. Also, I think there's nothing really on the issue that does concern me a lot, which is how parent choice allied to school autonomy and particularly freedom and admissions does tend to lead to a more sort of segregated system. And I am continually worried about the idea of expanding more and more autonomous schools that have freedoms that other schools don't have. So, I mean, there's certainly a lot in there, yeah, sure. And there's also the whole issue of school funding. And, you know, he says he's going to put funding through local authorities, but actually if you read it very closely, he is hoping to move to a national funding formula, and I think that will marginalise the role of local authorities in education provision in their areas.
Johnny, higher standards, better teachers. What's not to like?
No one could dislike that. I mean, I think there are a few things to say about this. First, yet another massive radical plan from this government. I mean, they are taking our breath away. I think it's flooring the opposition. It's bamboozling the media. Each week, something enormous that would normally dominate a news agenda for a month or two is coming from this government. And I don't know whether the electorate feel they were warned for that. I mean, the NHS reorganisation that was announced from Andrew Lansley, he says, is the biggest ever. And Michael Gove said his plan for education is going to be the biggest reorganisation of education for a generation. His staff saying, well, maybe since 1944 Education Act. I mean, the question of whether this government has a mandate for doing these enormous things is a big question in the background. He set the bar very high for himself as well, says he wants the English education system eventually to be the best in the world. I think that's a hostage to fortune. People are going to judge anything that goes wrong against that extremely high standard. And then in the detail, People are going to want to know, is there something more than just this sort of exhortatory bully pulpit call for there to be better teaching? And I think you heard it there in Fiona Miller. How does he actually make that happen? And that's always the hardest thing for governments. They have acknowledged rightly that teaching and learning in the classroom is the most important thing. How do you get your hands on that? And I'm not yet convinced I know the answer to that from what we've heard yet.
Raf? Oh, I think John's absolutely right. There are some interesting, because there's so much of it, inevitably there are contradictions in it. One of them is the contradiction that always occurs when you try to do massive, as it were, decentralization by a central state. So you're setting schools free to do what you would like them to do, which is a very peculiar definition of freedom. They have to follow. And the other slight contradiction is when you read the white paper, he's clearly wanting to strip away some of the sort of social engineering functions that Labour put onto schools. The fact that teachers, as well as imparting knowledge, would want to be in charge of, or would want to be responsible for, children eating healthily and taking more exercise and generally being well-rounded citizens. So he's taking that out and saying, let's have a much more stripped down academic type curriculum, wearing blazers and having a house system, and it all feels a bit 1950s. But at the same time, at the forefront of it, as Johnny says, he's setting this enormous engineering project, which is to make these schools better, more social mobility, completely transform society. So it's going to be tricky. Either he wants to just have good results, or he wants to transform society. But it's quite ambitious.
Julian, this government's meant to be decentralising. This sounds a bit of a muddle.
Well, I think the point Raf makes is an interesting one, which is that there is a conflict almost within Michael Gove between two very different objectives. There are the liberal objectives of creating a radically decentralised, genuinely diverse school system with a variety of different providers providing schools which will look and feel very different to each other, a system with parental choice at its heart. That's a very liberal vision. But then there's the traditionalist, the conservative part of Michael Gove, who wants chalk and talk and rows of desks, you know, facing the front, and school uniforms and chess club in the lunch break and all the rest of it. And he's got to decide, to be honest. You know, you either take a prescriptive interventionist approach as Secretary of State, tell schools what they should be doing, or you don't, or you let a thousand flowers bloom. You know, I think the bit of this agenda which is exciting is the liberal part of the agenda, because what we will see, hopefully, is by giving real freedom to schools, you will give them the space to innovate, the space to experiment, and that we know is the driver of higher standards in any field.
Follow up on that. I agree, and I think ultimately it really comes down to whether or not that liberalisation, the academy schools, the free schools, works. Because if it works, or if you think it will work, then all the other stuff, the curriculum, the uniforms, is sort of commentary and by the by. Most of it quite sensible, actually, the discipline stuff quite sensible. If the free schools and the academies doesn't work, then the other stuff's irrelevant, because you're going to have inflicted such a violence on the school system. No one cares what uniform kids are going to be wearing. So it's the second half, it's the structural stuff that matters. Yeah. And the rest is kind of commentary.
And the structural stuff, to be honest, is all going to come down to money. You know, that's the real problem, which is that he is hoping to see enough new schools open up to actually make to bring about systemic change. Now, that's not easy to do when there's not much cash around, you know. And the way they did this, they got around this in Sweden, of course, is they said anyone can open a school, but you have to pay the upfront costs, the startup costs.
And you can make a profit from running the school.
That point about the cost goes to, again, what point that's true wider of this government, which is that nobody thought that you could launch programmes and plans of this ambition in a time of austerity. If you'd have rewind back to May the 6th or May the 10th or 12th when the government launched, you'd have thought two things about this militated against radicalism. One, it's a coalition and it lacks its own mandate. No party's got a majority. And two, we're in a time of everyone's tightening the belt. So the one thing you can be sure of is they're not going to be able to do much. That's what you'd have thought. The opposite has been true. And yet it is very, very risky, because something like this plan, ultimately, always there's going to take money. I mean, if you go back to what the argument that was going on with the New Labour about even foundation hospitals and other things was surplus capacity. If there's any kind of surplus capacity, that's a waste of money, said Gordon Brown. That was his position as Chancellor. Now, this is all about surplus capacity. It's saying, let's have all these new schools pop up, and we're not going to be rigid about saying who exactly goes where, because the system will sort of shake out for the best. But that's the sort of thing you do in a warm climate. You don't do that in a cold climate and of austerity. And the risks here are very obvious.
Looking back at yesterday, you know, it was an interesting day because actually the education secretary was kept off the front pages, kept off the top of the news bulletins by the students and school children protesting about the government. You know, the Lib Dems, you said about their proposals for schools and how exciting they are, but can they actually repair their relationship with young people? They seem to be enormously unpopular, the latest Guardian poll said, with young voters.
Yeah, and, you know, let's be honest, it's unsurprising. They campaigned as a party for the abolition of fees, and they are now trebling those fees. So, you know, this
it doesn't look great, does it?
It doesn't look great. You can't get away from
when you
that.
Put it like
and,
that.
And they're taking a hit. But here's the real point. To my mind, the mistake that the Lib Dems made was not breaking their pledge; it was making it in the first place. You know, I really believe that this was a classic bit.
Yes, but where do they go from now? How do they repair that damage?
Well, I mean, I think they have to just stick to the course. You know, the alternative policy, the policy they had in opposition, was fit, frankly, only for opposition. I'm not convinced that the taxpayer should foot 100% of the higher education bill anyway. But in a time, you know, in a time when we're trying to deal with a £150 billion deficit, it's completely out of the question. So they're in the right place in policy terms. It is the route they've taken to get there that is so uncomfortable, of course. And, you know, they've taken a hit. Only time will repair that.
Raf, have the Lib Dems lost a generation?
Well, it's interesting because I think probably yes. And I sense that where they are now, they have to set themselves up as the sort of technocratic McKinsey go-to guys for coalition. It becomes very important for them to legitimise coalition and responsible governance as their brand, which is so far away from where they were a year ago. And two things I think will emerge from that. One, it becomes quite important for them to go into coalition with Labour in Scotland next year after the elections to say, look, we can work with different people, we're just the sort of government doers. And the other point is I think they're being pushed now into a position which a lot of sort of wet Tories would like a lot, where they have to fight the next election as a coalition. And they really resist that. And a lot of the top Lib Dems hate that idea because it means absorption into the Tories. But I think they're being pushed into a position where they have to essentially do that.
I think you're certainly right about Scotland. I think it's a very interesting point that they need to prove that they are sort of ambidextrous in their coalition abilities. But to go to York, the consequence of that, for the point you raised, Tom, about their appeal to young people, I see that as being wholly unappealing to young people. In other words, this very pragmatic, technocratic, you call 1-800 coalition and, you know, this is who you get. That may appeal to a sort of good governance strand within the electorate, which I would be amazed if it makes it into, you know, a single percentage point. But younger voters liked the fact they were principled, they were different, they were against the establishment. That vote must have just gone, and not just young people, actually. All those, you know, the Guardian constituency saw something appealing in them as an oppositional party. Now, if they represent government with a small g, I think that's incredibly unappealing. So I don't know what electorally they do with that.
While Michael Gove is keen to make pupils more socially mobile, he seems less keen about getting them moving on the playing fields. Ed Miliband made the cuts to funding of after-school sport the main topic of Prime Minister's questions.
I do say this to the Prime Minister. This is frankly a daft decision. It is a daft decision which he should U-turn on as soon as possible. And I'm afraid it sums up this Education Secretary. High-handed, incompetent and unfair. Why doesn't the Prime Minister get a grip on it?
Johnny, Ed's back from paternity leave amid a lot of criticism of his leadership. Is he dead Ed, not red Ed?
Oh, he's certainly not dead Ed. I mean, that's, you know, even by our standards in the media, that would be madly premature to say that about him. No, there's an anxiety going on in the upper reaches of the party about quite how to play opposition. And you hear both positions coming out the same people. I mean, other people are torn on it. They like the fact in a way that he's pacing himself and it's a marathon, not a sprint, and you can't do it all at once and it's going to last 4.5 years. And our colleague Jackie Ashley coined this rather nice phrase, Zen socialism. You know, this image of him sitting sort of cross-legged on the floor, eyes closed, incanting om rather than, you know, frantically looking at the first editions at 11 o'clock at night. You know, that's appealing on one level. On the other hand, people worry that this impressions form very quickly. And Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's former chief of staff, saying, you know, he thinks he's fast running out of time to make any dent at all with the public, as if the public take a sort of snapshot, you know, blink test, someone said to me this week, after the Malcolm Gladwell essay Blink. People come to instant judgments. Are they forming a judgment of Ed Miliband, which is, you know, nice guy, but doesn't matter much, you know? And that is really worrying Labour people, and they're torn because they don't quite know how, 4.5 years out from an election, what you say. And something like that attack in PMQs, there are some people who think, yeah, that's good. word, opportunist, nimble, finding the moment. Others, you say, that's such a sort of side issue and you've got to be going frontally on the economy week in, week out. This is the week Ireland has tanked. Ed Miliband should have been saying, you are reckless, you are on the same path, so that if the economy goes really sour, he can be saying, you know, we warned you. And you just hear this going on, and like I say, it's going on within individuals. People are very, very torn on how he's doing it. The one thing you don't get is anybody saying he's doing it exactly right.
I love this phrase I came across the other day, which is ednostic. I'm slightly ednostic. I think there are a lot of people who sort of quite liked some of the themes that came out of his leadership campaign, this sort of heartfelt, authentic, social democratic urges that you sort of wish could be an electorally credible position in this country, but slightly fear isn't. And that's the sort of agnostic position. I think he has a great problem, which was described to me by a Labour MP recently, which is that he has to now kind of triangulate himself, that because of the tactical manoeuvres he made to the left to beat his brother in the election campaign for leadership, he now has to demonstrate that he can do all these other things. And I think that gives him a problem strategically, that his the biggest claim that you need in leader of the opposition at this moment is sort of character and authenticity. And the character thing, it is a problem that he took on his brother and beat him in the leadership. And the authenticity will be a problem if he now starts having to sound a lot more like David Miliband. And I think, you know, as a Labour MP said to me the other day, you know, you close your eyes and you tell yourself it's going to be all right, and maybe it will. But I think he has got quite big problems, to be honest.
Julian, you've got a lot of experience of opposition being a Lib Dem. What's your advice?
I mean, I think the Labour Party has still not had the fundamental discussion, internal discussion it needs to have about its direction. I mean, ever since Blair stood down as leader, they have not really decided what comes after New Labour. If it's not New Labour, what is it? And I think the problem with Ed Miliband is that I don't think he fully knows the answer to that question. And, you know, this links us back a little bit to the Clegg lecture here at The Guardian earlier this week. He was asking a question which I don't think the Labour Party have got an answer to, which is, what does it mean to be a progressive when there's no money left? I mean, that's a big question which is going to hang over the Labour Party for the next 4 years. Is it simply going to sit in its own comfort zone, opposing cuts? And if it is, I've no doubt that the Labour Party will benefit throughout midterm. It'll in opinion polls, it'll look like it's on course for something. But come the crunch at the next election, when people are choosing a prime minister and a government, I don't think that's going to be enough. I think they have to set out a positive alternative vision for government, and I'm not convinced that Ed Miliband knows what that is.
I think also, organisationally, they've got a tactical problem, which is that they also have to... The government is being very effective at premising every single sentence with, and this is all a product of Labour's overspending, and the reason we're in this situation is because Labour threw away all the money. Now, macroeconomically, that's not true. But nonetheless, they're very good at saying it. And Labour people are appalling at getting their rebuttal into that as quickly and effectively as the accusation is going out.
Last answer to you, Johnny.
No, I completely agree about poll numbers. And anyone who remembers Neil Kinnock's poll numbers in the 80s, he was always up during midterms and then always down on the only poll that mattered, which was election day. So there's no comfort in that. It's an interesting question, Clegg's question. The question I think also Labour hasn't even answered is, why did we lose the election? And how would we do things differently? And they're torn between the very pragmatic answer, and Ed himself is, which says personality problems of the leader, bad times economically, we were knackered 13 years, pragmatic sort of contingent things, rather than actually getting to grips with, was there something about what we were doing that fundamentally had broken the trust with the British people and the British people no longer liked? And that's the harder question. As for a progressive government with no money, I mean, I think I'm with Raf in a way on that, if this is his position, which is, I think you've first got to get in there and attack that premise that it was you who threw it all away, we've inherited this mess. There was a huge economic crisis, we're seeing it in Dublin. You know, last time I checked, Gordon Brown wasn't Prime Minister of Dublin, of Ireland, and nor of Greece, nor of Portugal, nor of Spain, nor of the United States. You know, Labour has to keep saying this was a global crisis and we were dealing with it just like everyone else. And at the moment, I think one of the criticisms of Ed's leadership is that argument is slightly going by default, I think.
Well, if there's some rumblings of backbench discontent, it's not confined to Labour. This week, Tory MPs were told that despite Britain staying out of the Eurozone, the Treasury was still on the hook for billions of pounds worth of rescue funds for Ireland, with more on the horizon if other countries need help.
Given that the very large loan to Greece on May the 2nd did not stop the rolling euro crisis, despite the promises from many of the participants at the time, will the Chancellor assure the House that Britain does not stand ready to lend more money to other Eurozone members in the event that this Irish loan package doesn't mark the end of the crisis either?
That was John Redwood giving George Osborne a hard time. Raf, how big a problem is Europe now for the coalition?
Well, for the coalition, I think it in the short term, I don't think it's that bad. I mean, I think essentially because the Lib Dems are sort of pro-European and the right wing of the Conservative Party is sort of massively hostile, and the UK isn't in the euro, they can probably bumble along being the sort of the biggest economy in the outer tier of Europe for a while. I think longer term, it's a massive problem that as a result, Britain cannot meaningfully engage in the conversation about where the European Union generally is headed, because actually there is a crossroads in the eurozone. It will either fall apart or be forced into a proper fiscal union where you have real transfer mechanisms and the kind of inner core federal state type structure that the Eurosceptics have always hated. Now, it might be great for the right wing of the Conservative Party or a lot of British people that Britain's not part of that, but Britain does kind of need to be involved in that conversation at a level more sophisticated than, frankly, it has been.
What are the Lib Dems in the government saying about Europe? Well, what are they pushing for?
I mean, before we go on to that, I would just question whether or not the Ireland story is really about Europe at all. I think there's a lot of confusion about this. What's happening in Ireland is what happened in America and what happened in Britain, neither of which are part of the euro, which is that their banks got massively overexposed, particularly in relation to mortgages. The housing market. I mean, the problem in Ireland was they were building 90,000 houses a year, you know, in a country of, what, 4 or 5 million people. And their banks are massively exposed to that. And this what this story is about is the banking crisis coming back. Now, that's a separate story from what's going on in southern Europe to large part. There may be an issue about
Spanish
banks.
But it does expose, a tension within the coalition MPs, Tory and Lib Dem, and it also exposes how, despite the fact we're not in the Eurozone, we are liable to support Eurozone countries in who are in trouble.
But again,
it does expose those two tensions. You can argue about...
But with Ireland, we are supporting them. It's got nothing to do with the euro, really. I mean, we would support them anyway. We've got huge amounts of trade with Ireland. You know, it's been pointed out a lot of times this week that we do have more trade with Ireland than we have with all the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, put together. You know, we have a land border with Ireland. So we would be doing this anyway. I just don't think that the Irish story is particularly a story about the single currency. It's not the single currency that got the Irish where they are now.
But it may explain why partly other countries feel that they have to bail out Ireland because of the prospects for the euro. But even if it is, and I think I accept a lot of what Julian said there, even on those terms, that kind of problem is a political problem, I think, for particularly George Osborne. I mean, the argument that we have to because we do more trade and everything else, I think that's fine. I personally find it quite persuasive. But to go to an electorate who you have been telling every single day, 10 times a day, there is no money left for anything, and we know you value your local library, and we know it's very important to you, this public service for the elderly, but sorry, there's no money left. Actually, there is money left. There's 7 billion when we need to help out banks in Ireland. That is a very populist argument, and I think undermining for the government. And now, in a way, they get to know a bit of taste of the kind of Labour's medicine. This is the position Brown was in. So hold on a minute. You're bailing out for 7 billion these banks that are not even in our country, but you're somehow attacking all the time Labour for doing the same when our own banking system was about to go down. So which is it? And I think it's crude, and there are good subtle economic arguments for why we have to do it, to do with preserving the banking system and our trading relationship, but it's just in the simple terms in which these things are often discussed in the public square, I think it's quite undermining.
Well, turning to you, Julian, if we accept Raf's point that this sort of financial crisis can be a driver for further economic integration in Europe, that does create a problem for the coalition, and one of which the Lib Dems in the government do have to take a position.
Yeah, and I think that that is the spectre of further European integration is real. I mean, it's out there. You know, we're already seeing a lot of talk about fiscal integration. Now, you know, that is unquestionably of huge constitutional import. If countries within a single currency are going to start aligning their fiscal policies, their tax and spend, I mean, that is, goes to the very heart of what governments do. But, you know, I come back to the George Osborne point. I think optically, that's not how it's going to work at all. George Osborne is absolutely flying at the moment. You know, he summed up the other day by saying, back in May we were part of the problem and today we're part of the solution. You know, we're helping the Irish. We've sorted out, we're out of the danger zone. You know, the growth figures are quite good. The unemployment figures aren't as bad as many people were expecting. There is an export-led recovery underway in the UK.
Which, but if he keeps telling people there's no money left and he finds 7 billion, how do you keep explaining that?
Yeah, but I think that the idea that the loan to Ireland is in British economic self-interest is one that is quite easy to explain and probably quite one that most people would buy.
I think it's certainly the first part of that
last point.
I would agree. I mean, I got sent on Friday a graph from Conservative headquarters pointing out very clearly how, you know, sort of British debt looked a lot like Portuguese and Irish debt up until the election, and suddenly went off and became much safer, you know, out of the danger zone. But the fact is, you're going to get a situation where, I think Johnny's right, where the economics is saying you must preserve the interests of bondholders, and the politics are saying, why are the people in the financial world who caused this crisis, you know, having to be bailed out of our pockets? And politics and economics are going to start pulling in very different directions in that respect.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. There's more on the Irish financial crisis on our economics podcast, The Business. My thanks to Johnny Friedland, Raphael Baer, Julian Astle. I'm Tom Happold. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.